They're a tough crowd, aren't they?
Oh, man. Hard bunch.
Well, this is going to be easy for you.
Oh, okay.
I'm not a harsh interrogator. You won me over when you said early on that your parents listened to the Lutheran Hour and Dr. Walter A. Meyer. That's Walter Arthur Meyer. And I succeeded him a couple times removed, once by the Board of Health, once by the Police Department.
Yeah.
And I'm Dale Arthur Meyer, and so my friends used to say the Lutheran Hour has gone from wham to damn.
And, are you related at all?
No, not at all. So I certainly hope that you don't have the wham to damn experience here. Have you been to Concordia Seminary before?
No, here? No, I don't think so. No, I haven't.
How have you enjoyed your day?
I have enjoyed it very much. Before I came, a Lutheran pastor in the town that I know, and one of the people on our staff who's from Lutheran Church, said, "You're going to Concordia Seminary." I said, "Yeah, how'd you know?" So he said, "Well, we've got a man in our church who, when he read you were going, said, 'Who in the world is that?' And he lives down the road from me. And why in the world are they having somebody like that at Concordia? I thought that was a Lutheran seminary." So I, you know, felt that to be like a lion in a den of Daniels, but it's turned out well.
We'll vote for you.
Okay, good.
My daughter is dating a Baptist.
Wow, she's moving up.
Well, we think of him as a pre-Lutheran. Now, a lot of us, myself included, have our main, perhaps only, experience with this campus, this Concordia. Would you tell us a little bit about Gordon Conwell?
Yeah, Gordon Conwell is located in South Hamilton, Massachusetts. Gordon Conwell, the two were put together in 1968. Billy Graham, Howard Pugh of the Union Oil Company, and Harold John Ockingay, who was pastor of the Park Street Church in Boston, wanted to bring the Gordon College Graduate School of Religion and the Conwell School of Religion, which was at Temple University. Temple University started as the seminary, and then the tail and dog got all mixed up. And they put Billy Graham on that board with a view of his taking it, and they put the two together, and that's how it became Gordon Conwell. We have about 1,700 and maybe 1,750 students. We have three campuses. We have one in South Hamilton, have another in Boston called CUME, Center for Urban Ministry Education, and another campus down in Charlotte. So we're spread out a bit.
Does it have a denominational affiliation?
No, it's a freestanding seminary. The largest single group of students, you take all the bunches, are Presbyterian, and that would be PCUSA, Evangelical Presbyterian, Orthodox Presbyterian. I think the second group would be some form of a Baptist or Congregational. And then we have, I think, 35 different denominations on our campus.
So it's a potpourri of denominational students.
Yeah.
You mentioned Billy Graham, and in your book, Making a Difference in Preaching, you begin this way, and I interpret this quotation as favorable, and we will test your diplomacy now. Maybe stir up the waters. 1966, a World Congress on Evangelism was held in Berlin, and Billy Graham was the honorary chairman, the acting chairman, Carl F.H. Henry. And he said, when he introduced Dr. Graham, quote, "Several years ago, after Billy Graham graduated from Wheaton College, I urged him to go on to the seminary. Fortunately, Billy did not take my advice. Had he done so, we might have lost the most effective evangelist of our generation." Now that, I'm sure, puts the faculty and a lot of the students on edge. So let us test your diplomacy here, Doctor.
Well, if you look at the people who have been in our generation who have been strong in evangelism. You think of Billy Graham or Bill Bright, or folks in the Navigators, I mean, whatever groups you look at. None of them went to seminary. And one of the concerns that I have, having been a seminary president and seminary professor in my life, is that sometimes you can get so, something happens, that people get so caught up in theological education that they lose their heart for reaching people for Christ. And I think one problem that we often have is that go through seminary, you come in wanting to be a pastor, you go out wanting to be a professor. And that's the wrong way to go. And I think where you are forced, as you are here, to interact with people and people who are not Christians, nothing would be is better than that for somebody in theological education. We, Bonnie and I, try to relate to non-Christians in New England. It's been the toughest single thing we've done. Not to find non-Christians, but to have personal relationships with them. Just recently, we've been able to, it took us 13 years to win some of our neighbors to Christ. But I think it's essential. I think, and yet it's very, very difficult because you live within a community of other Christians and you don't easily have relationships with non-Christians.
I think you brought it together very nicely in the book. You said, we need a band of men and women who are theological evangelists and evangelistic theologians.
Yeah, I think you need both.
In the time that we have, I'd like to zero in on the person who is both theological evangelist and evangelistic theologian. In other words, I'd like to talk about the person of the preacher.
Okay.
Not so much as you've done today and done admirably, talking about the techniques of producing expository sermons, but just the person who is the pastor, the preacher, specifically this person. And let me begin that little delving by asking you about the ice pick. Yeah, you got it.
You dug into my past.
And I should say, you remember ice where you have to have a pick to do that? Those of you who have gray hair or studied ancient history. Dr. Robinson has an ice pick story.
Well, I grew up in New York. And in an area of New York that's one of the toughest areas in the city. My mother died when I was a boy, and my father reared me. And so I was left to myself quite a bit. And to grow up in our neighborhood, you had to be part of a gang. My dad was a Christian, and yet he went to work at 2 in the afternoon, got home at 11 at night, and so I'm sure he committed me to the Lord. But one night, I was with a gang, 100 guys or more, and one of the fellows in our gang, two of them had actually been killed, one in pretty badly beaten. We were going to go avenge their death. And gang wars were part of life in Harlem. And so because it was a tough neighborhood, the police traveled in fours, usually 2 black officers, 2 white officers. And we were there, and this patrol car pulled out, and one of the policemen got out and for some reason went through the crowd and picked me out of the crowd and searched me and found this ice pick. And he said, what are you going to do with that? And I said, chop ice. And he said, you blankety blank, little blankety blank, get the blankety blank. You can fill in the blanks depending on your background.
No, they can't.
No.
They have no idea
yeah.
what you're talking about.
And then he kicked me, just sent me sprawling across the street. And I went home. And that night, they really had a bloodbath. I mean, it was a bad night. And I think if you dip your hand in blood, it's awfully hard to get it clean again. And I never told my dad about that. But I look back at it, and I think the foot of the policeman was the hand of God. And I think in an interesting, strange way, he intervened.
There was somebody in those early years named John
Mygott.
Mm-hmm. Mygott? Yeah. Would you tell us about him and the impact he had on your life?
Well, my cousin and I began to go to a Presbyterian church. We were on a spiritual search. We were looking for a church that had a basketball team. And so we, and that's when I discovered that every silver lining has a cloud. To go to play on the team, you had to go to Sunday school at least 3 Sundays a month. And John Mygatt was a Sunday school teacher. He showed his love for the boys in his class a couple of ways. One was he taught an interesting Sunday school lesson. I've come closer to being bored out of the Christian faith and reasoned out of it. And he did a great job of that. And then he visited our apartment. As far as I can remember, he was the only person in the church that came to visit our apartment. But he took an interest. One time I had broken my glasses, and I didn't get them fixed. I was just too lazy to get them fixed. There was a thing. And he saw me after class, and he said, "Look, I'm saving money for a new suit. I don't need a new suit. Here, take this and get those glasses fixed." I didn't need the money. I didn't take the money. But I was profoundly impressed that here's a man who'd give up a suit to buy me glasses. I had his funeral just a couple of years ago. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. And what John the Baptist did in introducing people to Jesus, John Mygatt did, bring me to Christ. Well, he had a great impact.
Sometimes I get the idea that incarnation is something we talk about, but is it possible for us to be unincarnate preachers of the word, to not be affected by the John Mygatts and the ice picks of our life?
I think... We ought not be that way. I think it's possible for people to be very cerebral. And I think in good communication there's some self-revelation. You have to be careful of it. But if you listen to a preacher preach for, say, 6-8 weeks, and you don't know anything about him personally, you've learned a lot about him, kind of person he is. Because people don't hear a sermon. They hear a preacher. They hear you. And... after a while, you understand the passion. So I think it's possible, but I really don't think it's very profitable. I think you are you. And whatever techniques you learn about homiletics, don't let it kid your personality. I mean, be yourself. Be your best self. but don't be afraid to do that. And I think in our day, especially, if you're trying to reach this younger, not very young, 40 and under. If you don't have some self-revelation, you're not going to reach them. Because they want, more than anything else, to know if you're authentic. This thing has done anything in your own life. I mean, they just cry out for it. I find it with the students at the seminary. When I went through seminary, I don't know that I knew my professors that well. It was just that for that generation, well, they didn't really open up that much. But today, students, in the best sense, demand it. They want to know you as a professor. There's got to be some of you as you put the sermon together.
Tell us more about your schooling.
Well, I went to high school in New York, went to Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina. Never put that in my resume. It always comes out wrong. depends on who reads it. I went to Southern Methodist and got my master's degree in communication and sociology. Then I went to the University of Illinois and got my PhD in communication with a minor in radio and television. I wrote my dissertation on an analysis of the audience for religious radio television programs in 8 sections of the United States. Up until that time, nobody had ever analyzed the audience for religious radio and television programs. They were selling bread. They went out and interviewed people about the bread of the program, but never about religious programs. After I did my research, I went to Washington for the National Association of Broadcasts. I had all this great information. One thing was that it's a rule. You don't have that many non-Christians listening to religious radio programs. You have Christianized people, but, you're talking the pagan. And yet the appeal that most of the programs made was that we're reaching the lost. And I wanted to tell him, you know, this bad news, good news, this was all about. The guy took me aside and said, nobody wants to know that here. The way you raise money is by telling people who don't reach anybody else that if they support your program, they'll be reaching non-Christians. And you can do anything you want on the program, but that's got to be the appeal. I've always flirted with cynicism. In fact, I date it rather regularly. but I was a tough...
Now, from the Lutheran hour, I would like to... but you're right. That was a discovery that we made, or at least I made. Religious people, spiritual people, Christianized people listen to religious programming. The ones we claim to be seeking won't.
Yeah.
And won't turn on that.
It doesn't say anything about the program. It's just that Republicans listen to Bush and the Democrats listen to Kerry if they listen to anything.
Now, during your schooling, were you married?
I got married between my senior year at college and going into seminary. So I went through seminary married.
When I and my classmates went through, we tended to be single, although they dropped off like flies. I shouldn't say it that way. That suggests the wrong thing. But and now most of them are married. Most of the seminarians are married. And as a seminary professor and president, do you see what difficulties, just honest personal difficulties that the married student has over against a single student?
Well, probably don't have much difficulty if you come and you're just married. It becomes more difficult when you have children. Then that adds a whole dimension because often going through seminary, the wife can work, but then when a baby comes, it's much tougher for the wife to work, or the arrangements they have to make for the children add difficulty. I think today, as opposed to the past, fellows come to the seminary, they get married, and they assume that their wives are on their team, they discover that their wives are on their back. She didn't figure when you were called, she was called. And as they get closer to going out into ministry, a wife can be very threatened by that. She sees a role that I think is changing in churches, but sees this role. If you as a married man, if you don't cultivate your wife, you're an idiot. I don't care if you take a lower grade in a course. You never swore to this faculty, I can say this, but you never swore to our faculty, but to love and to honor and cherish till death parts you. You may feel like that sometime, but you never made that up. But you did make that to your wife. And you really need to take that seriously. I'm astonished today how many pastors end up in divorce or immorality. I just think you can't afford not to cultivate your wife. Anyhow, for what it's worth. There's one wife there.
This is being recorded. And so can we put the word out, publicity people, to every sem wife, that they can hear what Dr. Robinson just said.
And play it to their husbands.
Play it to their husbands over and over again. You know, they're so busy studying theology while the wife is out working, trying to keep the ends going together.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thank you for that, because that's been a cultural shift that I'm not sure that we always realize when we're in the middle of it. You have children?
I have two. I have a son who's a pastor in Tarrytown, New York. And he and his wife have two boys, who are grandsons. One is 15, the other is 11. Then I have a daughter who lives in Dallas who does motivational speaking for corporations, travels all over the world in some ways. And then her husband's a sportscaster, does a three-hour talk show in the morning, and has been on ESPN and so forth. So at least three of them are in communication. It's fun to keep tabs on. I talk to my son regularly about sermons or what's going on. Whenever my daughter's working on new talks, she flies up to Boston and we spend a couple of days together. So it's been one of the delights of my life to be able to share with my children something of what I've learned.
The apples didn't fall far from the tree.
No. They may be better than the tree, though. Somehow the analogy gets lost.
The focus in this interview is on the person of the preacher, and not so much the techniques of producing sermons. And one of the things that happens to us inevitably is that we get beat up in ministry.
Yeah.
You served as the president of Denver Seminary and had an experience that you write about openly in your book. Could you share that with us, please?
Yeah, after, interesting, after I resigned from the seminary, determined to go to Gordon-Conwell, we were sued. Seminary was sued three times, and in one of the suits, my wife and I were co-defendants. We were sued in that suit for $1 million. The other suits were in that range. And at first, I didn't take them seriously. These were three different people that we had tried to help. And it was sort of like washing their feet and getting kicked in the mouth. I mean, it was, but I didn't take it seriously. And then in the course of 2 weeks, because there were three suits, I was questioned by the attorneys in a deposition. I went in thinking, well, this is a piece of cake. And they, for 8 hours, kept at you. And my lawyer had said, don't tell them anything that they don't ask. I remember when I was taking my PhD exams, my advisor said that, you know, just answer their questions, because if you answer more than their question, they'll go after that. So, you know, they ask a question like, did you have a telephone conversation from so-and-so? No. Did they write you a letter? No. And they'd space this, and then, you know, did you ever talk to so-and-so? Yeah. But they knew psychologically what that did was to make me feel like a liar. I mean, I told them what they wanted to know, but it was obvious that I wasn't telling them everything. Psychologically, they did it. They did that number. The second thing I discovered is they could get hold of all my correspondence. And I thought about that. And what would that be? There was anybody in that position. There would have been a number of people in the 12 years I was there who had come to see me and talk about something really difficult in their lives. And I thought, you know, I'll bet I may have written to somebody and said, I want you to know that what we've talked about is gone forever. I'll never share it with another person. I thought of that. And then I thought if they got hold of that, they could bring it up and say, all right, what was this that you were talking to so-and-so, writing to so-and-so about? And my lawyer might protest that this isn't relevant, and they would hear it. You don't have a judge in the deposition, and you've got to answer. If you don't answer, you're in contempt of court. And so I had to think, you know, would I betray a secret? Would I lie? If I didn't answer, they could put me into jail. I mean, for contempt. I did, and then in addition, one of the person sued us. My wife had tried to help her. In fact, she was going through a difficult time, and Bonnie went over several times, cleaned her house, and they wanted to talk to Bonnie. And my wife was terrified. She said, you know, you answer questions all the time. I don't. And she said, I don't want to say anything that would hurt you. And I said, honey, just tell them the truth. Just whatever it is, just tell them the truth. You know, but she was terrified. They decided to do the thing on telephone, because we were in South Hamilton in Massachusetts at the time, by telephone. Bonnie's a godly woman. I wish you could meet her. You'd think a lot more of me. She really is. And but she, she went to that room. She was terrified. And they got that They got that call started. And then the other people were in Denver. And the phone went dead. It was on their end. And they couldn't get it corrected. So they had to call off the interview. And fortunately, she didn't have to testify. You know, it was, so God said, you can take as no temptation take you, but you what you can bear. And I, you know, but that went on for over a year. And I didn't handle it well. I don't think I handled it well at all. I'd go out to pray. I'd walk, and we'd walk together. But I'd pray, and I got to the place where I didn't want to talk to God about it anymore. I'd say, Lord, you know it's on my heart. You have said vengeance is mine, I'll repay. If there's any vengeance, I give it to you. I know you to be a God of grace, so, but it's yours. I want to give it to you. But I don't want to talk about it to you, Lord, because it just brings all this junk up again. It was undoubtedly for us the hardest thing in our lives that we faced as a couple.
Did it affect you professionally?
Yeah, it's interesting. People who didn't really know that, I mean, anything about that, would say to me, there's a tenderness in your preaching that was not there before. And, you know, had they known about it, you'd say, well, they're just reading into it, but they didn't. They'd have heard me preach. I find, for example, I have a great sympathy for the Catholic priests who, you know, I realize it was wrong, I'm not defending, but I know what they're going through. And guilty or not, I know what they're going through. I know what it must be. To this day, one of the programs I enjoy watching on television, Law and Order. There's not much violence in that. But my wife can't watch it. Bonnie will not watch it. She just finds it just made that, you know. So it affects you. I think what I have gotten out of that is a greater tenderness for sinners. I watch these guys from Enron and so forth, and you know, watching them abstractly ticked off. But I can imagine what they're going through, and so I find myself identifying with the hurt in a way that I wouldn't have. I would have been very much more judgmental of everything that went on, but.
Is one of the lessons that we should draw from your experience is that we should always be legally mindful of what might happen?
Yeah, it's interesting. When I went back to Gordon Conwell, you know, we have little windows in our doors. And some of the faculty put their gown, their academic gown over it and covered it. And I said, look, you don't do that. Because if something goes wrong and you are accused and you go to court, the lawyer can make a lot out of that. You know, don't do that. And I said in one rash moment, I'm not going to counsel with anybody again. I'm out of here. One of my colleagues, lesson, said to me, you can't say that. You're a follower of Jesus Christ, and you can't divorce yourself from the pain of people. You take that risk. And he was right. But always the window in my door is open. And not because any of the things that happened to me were of that sort, but I just know the way lawyers work. And
well, excuse me, I would somebody go take the ulb off of my door and replace the frosted glass,
yeah,
too?
Yeah. Well, we had a professor at Gordon Conwell who, a student, came to see him. They felt he was demon-possessed, the student did. And the professor, you know, prayed with him, prayed for him. And about 6 months later, the student set himself on fire. And he didn't kill himself, but and they brought suit. It didn't go to court, but you can see what would happen. He said he was demon-possessed. You believe in demons? You believe they're all over? Well, you think talking to this person about demon possession was
You do that very often? Are you a professional counselor? And would have been dead in the water with a secular jury. And so that lawyers know, you know, the court case we had, a million, got settled for $70,000 for this insurance company to take a case to court. Cost them about $150,000. So they will settle out of court for $60,000, $70,000. In fact, I said, I want to settle. You know, let's go to court. Let's have it out. And the insurance company said to me, all right, you go. We've been willing to settle for $70,000. If a judgment comes against you for $1 million, you pay everything beyond the $70,000. Well, I mean, you know, I had no chips. I couldn't play. But lawyers know that, and therefore you have all kinds of lawyers that want to file suit because they come away with a piece of money.
Now, in describing this incident, you say that you personally came out of it, among other things, feeling vindicated about your conduct.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, vindicated in the sense that... I really can't say I felt vindicated. I was just glad it was over.
When you teach homiletics, do you teach, or in your observation of us preachers, do you see that we do very much validating of the struggles people have? The people struggling with Enron, or you talked about a possible abortion this morning. Do we validate where the sanctified people are struggling?
Yeah, I think sometimes people do not see us as a friend of publicans and sinners. I really believe if Jesus came back today, as he did 2,000 years ago, there are many of our churches that would hesitate to have him as a member. And there are many more of our churches that would not have him on the official board. They would not approve of the places Jesus went and the people he hung around with. And they just wouldn't. We look to the people out there in the community as though we were antiseptic. And there is a line between identifying with sinners and approving their sin. But I think preaching has to identify with sinners, without approving of their sin.
You tell about a story that you preached in Dallas on John 14 that you said in your book was disastrous. And I mean, I think you've already given us the bottom line that you forgot about the sinners out there. Yeah. But could you rehearse that for us briefly?
it
must have been good.
One of those dreadful times. I was asked to preach at the Schofield Church in Dallas. And they assigned me to John 14, my father's house, so many mansions. I studied that thing. Got all kinds of problems to it. What does he mean? I'll come again and receive you to myself. And I read too many commentaries, and commentators raise all kinds of questions. So I got up there. I was loaded for bear. There were no bear there. That they're just people. And I got into this thing. And you know what they wanted? These are an older congregation. They wanted to know that when they came to the end of life, God wasn't going to throw them into some ditch of a grave and forget them. He's going to take them home. He had a place for them if, he prepared a mansion. He prepared the world in 7 days. Imagine what kind of a mansion he would have. You can look forward to there and being with Jesus. They wanted that. And I thought what I gave him. And not only did people fall asleep, one man fell out of his chair onto the aisle. I mean, I didn't know how to get out of it. I think today I would say, look, this is not going anywhere. Let's go home. But back then, I didn't know what to do with it. And I still remember it. I mean, you brought it up, and now you've got all this coming in my mind. Yeah, that's a terrible thing to just feel, you know, you just have missed the audience totally.
Completely. I've been there, done that.
But you don't want to do it again.
Shifting gears here.
Yeah, I hope so.
Talking about the pastor as the preacher as a person. You have hobbies?
I hate that question.
That you can tell us about.
The answer is no, and I always sound like a drudge, you know. Have any hobby? No, I just go my work. But I enjoy what I do. If I have a hobby, that's what you'd call it, it's watching TV. I don't watch a lot of it. I do, at this time of year, watch some of the Red Sox game. But,
okay, reading the books.
Yeah.
I picked up baseball.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Now, you grew up in Harlem, so yeah. As a kid, who were you for?
I was for the New York Giants.
The New York Giants. Would you explain that to some of them?
Before they deserted us and went to San Francisco. And when you rooted for the Giants, you know, then you had your hatred straight because you despised the Yankees and the Yankee fans, and you hated the Brooklyn Dodgers. I mean, it was there. And then they all moved. And today I root for the Red Sox simply because I'm in Boston. Don't have quite the passion I did as a kid. But
did you ever use that ice pick on Yankee fans?
Well, I think I could be a hero in Boston, but I wouldn't want to go back to New York.
The person of the preacher. But let me ask two things about technique. Little interlude in our discussion. We Lutherans don't do expository very much. It's probably growing among us. But that's not our bread and butter style. So we appreciate what you did today. You're teaching us something that we congenitally don't do. And one of my ham buddies asked me if you would just give a simple definition of expository.
Well, my definition is it's a proclamation of a biblical concept, which is derived from and transmitted through a historical, grammatical, literary study of a passage in its context. And God makes that concept real to you as a preacher and then through you applies to the congregation. Taking it apart, it's preaching of a concept, not bits and pieces. Concept is derived from a study of that text and then transmitted through the text. And I think that's probably where expository preaching is separate from other preaching. That is, you show the people in the text where you're getting it from. You can't show them everything, but if they wanted to reconstruct the text, the argument of the text, and reconstruct that, they could do it on the basis of what you've given them.
I might say that the discussions you have in your writings are very illuminating. Even for a non-expository sermon.
Good.
And so I commend the books. Secondly, we do have in the library a videotape showing you in, is it Charlotte, North Carolina? It's the an Odyssey production.
Oh,
preaching
yeah.
on David and Bathsheba.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I found that an engaging sermon. And when they panned the crowd was all awake.
Yeah.
The second question that I have, and my students know that this is a bent of mine, how in the world did you stand up here for an hour and talk from memory without having your face buried in a manuscript? How'd you do that?
Well, we teach our students to do it, so you better learn how to do it yourself. I think one of the, you don't memorize, you internalize. And what you do is to think in pictures. It turns out that in terms of communication, that's a good way to communicate. Because as Walter Lippmann said, people think with pictures in their heads. And so to preach and to teach without notes is a way of preparing. A good sermon remembers itself. And So you go, you know what your major points are, but you go from that to a specific, that from an assertion to a specific. And if you have those pictures, you find that you can internalize. And, so that I do it now. And it has a lot to do with the way you prepare. If you prepare a manuscript, read a manuscript, you can put anything in a manuscript as long as you read it. It can be illogical, irrelevant. But if you have to preach without notes, you have eye contact, you're communicating, and you have to arrange the material in a memorable way.
On the other hand, if you had your head in a manuscript, you would have never seen that man fall out of his chair.
No, that's right.
Yeah.
that is an advantage of a manuscript. Yeah.
No, I thought that was a mnemonic tour de force, and I really appreciated your demonstrating that technique. Yeah. I did my dissertation in Greco-Roman rhetoric, and you were singing out of the Auctor Ad Herennium.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're... I knew there was a reason I liked you besides Walter A. Meyer.
Yeah.
Okay, back to the person...
By the way, who is the Lutheran Layman's League? They support you, don't they?
Well, they did. I'm not there anymore.
Okay.
I'm here.
Oh, your wife supports you now.
Could I talk to Bonnie? The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has historically two auxiliaries, the men and the women.
That's clever.
The men is they're kind of getting together now, finally. We used to sit separate in church, too, men and women.
Is that
yes,
right?
Yeah. Anyway, the LLL, Lutheran Layman's League, was a men's auxiliary, still is, and they produced the Lutheran Hour. And the LWML, Lutheran Women's Missionary League, is a ladies' auxiliary. Neither one of them is funded out of denominational offerings. So when you were talking earlier about religious shows, preaching to the choir and raising money, been there, done that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Although we never did it on the air. We never asked for money on the air. So now you have sidetracked me. The person of the preacher.
Oh, yeah.
Could you tell us, now in expository preparation, you spend a lot of time deep in the biblical text. Do you have a time with the Bible apart from professional preparation?
No. I don't know that. I think as a student at the seminary, I needed to have time in the text because at a seminary, you use it as a textbook. And you really got to, I just think have to, you're studying it in the original languages and so forth. I find that as I work on passages for our radio program for preaching, that study has to do something in me. And I find it difficult just to read the Bible without really getting into it and thinking about it and studying it. So the answer is, I generally know. I have a period of prayer every day, but not the reading of the Bible every day.
If I remember right, you invite a famous preacher into your heart and study for a year at a time. Is that correct?
Yeah, for a number of years.
Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, I take one pastor, somebody I've heard of. It's a good preacher. If he's somebody who's in the past, I read his biography and then read as many sermons as I can. Somebody in the present, I either try to read his sermons or hear his sermons. And if I get a chance to sit down and talk with them about how he prepared or prepares, I do that. I have found that has helped me over the years because sometimes I hit a wall and I think, well, what would Peter Marshall have done with this? Or what would Clovis Chappell have done with this? And what would Donald Gray Barnhouse do with this? And you sort of get that in a path in your mind. And so I found that for me, helpful, because each person comes at a text in a different way, or has different strengths, and I can borrow from their strengths.
So in a way, all your reading is devotional.
Yes, I think that's true. I think it, and thought of it, but it is, I am. I come to the Bible, it sounds very pious, but really believe that the Bible is the Word of God. That as Augustine said, when the Bible speaks, God speaks. And if I can understand this text in its context and so forth, I will really hear from God. And I believe that the whole scripture is that way. I think it's all profitable. And so when I come to the text, I really do come to say, Lord, help me understand this. More often, Lord, I think I understand it, but what in the world does this have to do with people today? That is more difficult for me. Go through Leviticus, I can, you know, that's not a hard book to understand. If you have to want to offer a sacrifice, it's like a recipe book. So it's exactly how to do it. You know, the trouble is, what's that got to do to the do with the person in the eighth row, four seats in? How do I bring that over?
So over the decades, this immersion in the Bible and in the great preachers has, I assume, actually entered your mind, your thought patterns, your diction is tied into the ages, is it not? It is. I'm telling you, it is.
Okay.
We take since it is a living word that cuts into us, that constant absorption of that word of God really becomes part of us, and we don't realize that we're doing it sometimes. But
you think you really end up thinking biblically, and our task, by the way, is not to make people moral. Pharisees were moral. It's to get them to think biblically. That's a much tougher task, but. That's what it means to think Christianly. And the more you can help a congregation do that, the better they'll be when it comes to life's tough decisions.
Moving to another question, Concordia Seminary is one of the two seminaries of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Missouri the state, not misery, a misery synod.
You had attacks, haven't you?
Would you analyze subjectively the health of American Christianity?
There are pockets of health, many pockets of disease. I think 85% of our churches are plateaued or declining. And that's a great pain. There are places where there is growth and vitality, I wonder sometimes if at any time in history you've been asked that, I've been asked that question, I could have said, you know, everything's in great health. What troubles me most today is the future. Some churches have really demonstrated you can reach non-Christians. The mega churches have really demonstrated you can be user-friendly, that people coming to church, the non-Christians, the secular people, you can attract them. And I really commend them for that. The question is, if you do evangelism on the weekends, and then you do your teaching ministry in the middle of the week, the people don't come back for the teaching, you know, whatever that is, then what do we do in the future? When you have had, as you, your parents and folks like, have been at the church all their lives, those people then passed on to the next generation what they knew and have just assumed they would do it. But now when you bring in people, the non-Christians who become Christians as adults, and hear me again, I commend that. The question is, what do they know about the faith that they're going to pass on to the generations to come? I really feel, when I wake up in the middle of the night and pray for the church, I do pray for that. And I don't have an answer for it. I have an uneasy feeling that the future is not going to be a strong biblical future.
I had a student once that said, "We preach, we don't teach." And you're laughing, right? And I didn't laugh. I had another reaction. The reason I preface that question with the word misery is because in all the traveling that I do, which is a lot, there are wonderful things going on out there. And sometimes, you know, we see some of the bad press that might come out of any denominational headquarters. But as somebody asked me when I was at the Lutheran Hour, how had the job affected me personally? And the answer was, and still is, it has made me a better believer, because all this stuff we talk about Jesus, his word, and the Spirit, it's true. It really does work. This has been great. I want to ask you one more terribly difficult question. But you have this vast experience. You have vast knowledge. I mean, and through the seasons of your life, you have been a dedicated servant since you put the ice pick down. What is your purpose now?
My purpose now is to prepare as many people as I can to be effective communicators of God's word to their generation. And I really, whatever years God gives me, I really want to do that. So I'll do it as well as I can.
And, well, you're doing marvelously. I'm convinced we learn a lot of our homiletics through modeling. And today you have modeled wonderfully for us, and we sincerely thank you for that. Where did that lizard ever end up? The lizard that was up on the 17th floor.
I have no idea. Probably still down there. I couldn't ask it because it was a Latin American lizard. I couldn't speak Spanish. Hey, look, it's been great to be with you. It really is.
Thank you.